Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And we're back, and we have a great guest for you. I've been looking forward to this interview for a number of weeks because we have Dr. David Eagleman, who is author of The Brain, The Story of You. It's been seen on PBS. He's a neuroscientist, New York Times bestselling author. Incognito is one of those, and synesthesia, which relates to brain plasticity, is his area of expertise. He now heads the Stanford Center for Science and Law, a national nonprofit institute, and serves as an adjunct professor there. He's best known for this work on the brain, and The Secret Life of the Brain is what Incognito was all about. Let me ask him a little bit about brain development. David, thank you for being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
We should tell people that you've got a little bit of a cold, so that's what happens when you have to travel all around to promote the book so well. So if you sound a little peculiar, it relates to, or sniffly, it does relate to that cold. Let me ask you about brain development. So one of the things you talked about was that the brain has... the brain cells form an incredible number of connections early in life with other brain cells. And I think it's almost too unbelievable to say how many more connections do they have per second or something?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, the general story is you've got almost 100 billion neurons, and each neuron is about as complicated as a city. So each neuron has the entire human genome in it. It's trafficking millions of proteins around. And each one of these 100 billion neurons is making about 10,000 connections, which means you have 1,000 trillion connections in the brain. So this is the kind of thing that bankrupts our language. And of course, we try to develop new strains of mathematics and computation to even try to get a hint of a shadow of what's going on there. But fundamentally, the most amazing part of this whole story is that is you, this incredibly complex system, is your hopes, your dreams, your aspirations, the agony, the ecstasy, all of that is happening there in your brain. And of course, the way we know that is because if you were to damage your pinky in a car accident, you'd be the same person. But if you damage an equivalently tiny chunk of brain tissue, that can change you entirely. So that can change your decision-making or your risk aversion or your ability to recognize music or see colors or name furry animals or 100 other things that we see in the clinics every day. And that's how we know that this incredibly complicated system is you.
Now, the other component, or one of the other components I wanted to get to on that development, was that we prune those connections till we hit to adolescence, when we grow them again. Is the pruning, and I've heard the thought that we don't prune them as well if we develop, for instance, autism spectrum disorders, or some forms of ADHD. I don't know whether that's a theory or whether that's been shown that group of people have more connections.
Yeah, the general story, just by way of background there, is that you're born and you live with a certain number of brain cells, and you don't grow new brain cells. Recent evidence has shown that there's a tiny little trickle, but it's almost negligible. So you have the number of brain cells you're going to have, but it's the connections between them that matter. So in the newborn brain, the neurons, the brain cells, are relatively unconnected to one another. What happens over the first 2 to 3 years is that they become increasingly connected. It's like it becomes like an overgrown garden. And after the age of about 2, that's when you get this pruning. It's like the pruning of a garden, where you are cutting back the number of connections that, that happen. And that's what happens for the rest of your life, is your experience with the world is shaping that garden. So the language that you learn, the experiences you have, and so on, that's what shapes which neurons remain connected. So, you know, it's kind of analogous to Michelangelo cutting out a sculpture from an enormous block of marble. It's like he reveals the sculpture from the block of marble. That's essentially what's happening here. I don't know if the evidence is strong enough yet to say that what's going on in autism or ADHD is that there's a lack of pruning. I mean, there is pruning that happens there too. The details of exactly how that pruning takes place, that's something unfortunate that we don't yet have the technology to be able to see the exact pattern of what is getting pruned there and why. So unfortunately, it will be another 50 years before we have something interesting to say about that.
Now, you also state, I think in the book, and correct me if I'm misquoting it, but my impression is that we also have another burst of these connections forming during adolescence.
Yeah, that's right. And what happens, you know, essentially adolescence, you've got all these software programs that unpack right when you turn, let's say around 13, and suddenly you're interested in parts of your body and other people's bodies that never interested you very much before. So you've got all these hormones coursing around in your body, and this causes obvious physical changes. But also, out of sight, our brains are undergoing equally monumental changes. And so you get, it's not so much that you get neurons connecting to each other more, it's that very specific parts of the brain start connecting to other parts of the brain. So just as an example, there's a part called the medial prefrontal cortex, and the details don't matter, but this is an area that becomes active when you think about yourself in relation to your peer group, and what your peers think of you, and so on. And what happens is that really comes online in terms of connectivity to other areas when you become an adolescent. And so that peaks when you're around 15 years old, that strength of connectivity. And so what happens is social situations carry a lot more emotional weight, resulting in, you know, a self-conscious stress response when you're dealing with your peers, and you really want to fit in with your peers. And so there's sort of a you know, this mirror of what's going on in the brain and what's going on socially that we can now identify.
Now, does that self, awareness, I guess I would say your self-value, your relationship with yourself, that you form during adolescence, does that remain for the rest of your life?
You know, the answer is that all sort of mellows like a fine wine as you grow older. So all the programs that come on life, when you really first become a teenager and you care so much about what your peers think, that gets competed with and in some sense overwritten by all these other competing programs you have as you mature and as you realize other paths and other ways of going, and as you've had a lot of experience with peers and you realize that what they think isn't the final arbiter of how you should behave. So as all of these different networks in the brain continue to get experience over the following decade, your behavior changes resultingly. The other thing I'll just mention one other thing that happens is that your prefrontal cortex, which is the part right behind your forehead, that continues to develop all the way until you're in your young 20s. So about 25 is when it finally reaches its maturity. And that's an area of the brain that's very involved in simulating future possibilities and evaluating them. And so what happens is, you know, young teenagers, and even in early 20s, people, for example, if you just look at their driving habits, people do a little bit crazier driving. As one gets older and more mature and just has more experience and a better capacity to simulate possible futures, that you know that's correlated with better driving. And of course, the car insurance companies have known this forever, and they charge differently depending on your age. And this is the kind of you know so that's an example of a clear brain maturation that we can witness happening all the way to about 25. But as I said, after that, you have just a lot of life experience that is all written into the exact patterns of the connections in the brain, and what you get is these alternative ways of doing things, and you just have better models of what's going on in the world.
Let me go and ask a set of questions I was planning to ask a little later, but it fits right now. That really determines how we are motivated, our rewards and incentives that we behave, that we pay attention to, does it not?
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. So there's a sense in which, you know, we look at teenagers and we say, hey, why don't you act more mature and not care so much about what your peers think and so on, but it's just a matter of what's going on under the hood in their brain. So their motivations, what they care about, all of that is related to what's happening in their brains. But of course, this is true at any age for any of us. You know, we like to generally think that we've got this organ in our skulls, but that's not us. Who we are and our motivations and how we behave is something separate. Unfortunately, what we've learned is that we are our neurobiology. We are what is happening under the hood there. And whatever is happening biologically, that determines who we are and how we behave. And, you know, a big part of what I do is right at the intersection of neuroscience and the legal system. And we see cases all the time where people have a change that takes place in their brain and their behavior changes accordingly. For example, they have a tumor or a stroke or some other kind of brain damage, and that totally changes their motivations, their behaviors, how they act in the world. And often, especially in the case of tumors, when they then get that tumor removed, their behavior is back to the way it was before. And that's a very striking sort of example when we see that kind of thing, because you know you didn't choose to have a brain tumor, and you, in the same way that you and I don't choose to have our genetics, all of our childhood experiences, none of that is a choice, and yet that shapes our biology to make it what it is. And therefore how we behave in the world.
Let me go to the health behavior, because one of the things that's costing us so much money in society now is our health costs based on our own choices. That is, whether we choose to smoke or not, whether we choose to do physical activity or not, the food choices we make and managing stress, and a few others like sleep. But what it appears to us in the Cleveland Clinic system, and let me give you the example. So at Cleveland Clinic, we started a program in 2009, and when you got to a certain amount of monetary incentive, $1,000 for an individual, $2,400 for a family of four, we were able to change behavior such that something like 93% of those who had six normal blood pressure, normal heart rate, normal waist for height, normal LDL cholesterol, no cotinine, no smoking end products in their urine, immunizations up to date, have kept them up to date since 2009. And 63.8% of those who didn't or had one or more abnormality in 2009 have now normalized those. And if you look at that generalizable, it's decreased our cost dramatically. But it also, if you see, we've done that with several firms in the same way. What is it that can get people to do this if it isn't a monetary change, and why does a monetary change get them to do it?
It's because what's actually happening in the brain is that you have different networks that are all competing to drive your behavior, and this is always true for all of us, where you have different voices in your head. So if I put some warm chocolate chip cookies in front of you, part of your brain wants that. It's a rich energy source. Part of your brain says, don't eat it, you're going to get fat. Part of your brain says, okay, I'll eat it, but I'll promise my spouse that I'll go to the gym tomorrow, and so on. And this is why you can cuss at yourself and cajole yourself and get angry at yourself and have conversations with yourself. Who's talking with whom here? It's all you, but it's different parts of you. And so in my book Incognito, I wrote a lot about how we are like a team of rivals under the hood, which was the, you know, this was what Lincoln did when he put together his cabinet. He put together a bunch of different people with differing opinions to help steer the ship of state. And so that's what's going on. And what that tells us is a very particular set of strategies about how to navigate that. So what happens is, for all of us, is that we find ourselves in moments of, you know, sort of very clear, sober thinking about who we want to be. And then, you know, when that's going on, our long-term thinking is engaged about the type of thing we're aspiring to. And what's very important there is to set up constraints on our own behavior while we're in this moment of long-term thinking. So this is what is called a Ulysses contract. And I wrote a lot about this again in Incognito, which is this issue that, you know, Ulysses, you may remember when he was coming back from the Trojan War, he wanted to hear the sirens. He knew they were going to pass the island of the sirens. He wanted to hear them singing, but he knew that every man who ever heard them singing would be tempted to go towards them, and then they would crash into the rocks, and that would be, you know, they would drown and die. So you may remember what Ulysses decided to do is he had his men lash him to the mast, and they put beeswax in their ears, and he said, no matter what happens, just keep on rowing. No matter what I'm screaming and shouting, just keep rowing. And that way he was able to hear the sirens. But what was actually happening is that the Ulysses of sound mind was making a contract for his future self, who he knew would behave badly. He knew that upon hearing the sirens, that Ulysses would behave badly, so he lashed him to the mast so he couldn't behave badly. So that's the key, and there are many ways to do that. You know, the first way is just minimizing temptation. So, for example, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the very first thing they have you do is clear all the alcohol out of your cabinets, out of your house, because the idea is that no matter how committed you are to stopping drinking, if there's alcohol there on a festive Friday night or a lonely Sunday night or something like that, you'll end up doing it. So the first thing you do is you minimize temptations. This is the same with drug programs. You don't carry more than $20 of cash in your pocket ever when you walk around. You just get in the habit of that. So if somebody, you know, tries to sell you something, you just simply don't have the wherewithal to do it. Another strategy for this kind of thing, which is exactly what you're talking about, is putting money on the line, is making it so that you've got some temptation, whatever that temptation is, whether that's you know, eating or drugs or simply not taking care of yourself, not going to the gym, not taking your medication. But what you do is you pit that against money, because money is a very useful basic reward, and so people. What you're doing is you're setting two of these neural networks against one another. So you feel like, well, I really don't feel like going to the gym, but if that's what happens, then I'm gonna lose this money. And there are lots of websites. There's one called StickK, STICKK, which where you select a goal, you set the stakes, and then you get a referee to judge this, and then you know, you add friends for support. And the idea is you're putting money on the line explicitly. Like you say, if I don't lose 12 pounds by, you know, July, then I've already put $100 with my credit card onto this website. And if I lose the thing and my referee and my support network agrees that I've lost the money, then I get the money back. And if I have not lost the weight, then the website gets to keep the money. And that's a very useful sort of thing to do.
Now, there's a couple of interesting things. If you look at if you look at our own population of roughly 100,000 individuals who we have in our health, in our employee health plan, they relatively all responded, meaning 63.7% of those who didn't have healthy normals all responded at roughly the same dollar value. But there are two things in society that are different than that. One is that women seem to be more attuned to their own health choices than men. Is there a difference in men versus women in this rational choice world?
I would actually say not much. I would not have, I mean, I know plenty of women who make poor health choices, just as many men. So at least with my sampling, I would say I don't know of one. And certainly from a neuroscience point of view, there's no inherent difference there. I mean, there's slight differences between the male and the female brain, and people really study this and try to pull out differences. But as a general operation, it's the same. It's the same biology.
And let me give you another analogy. Another fact. I founded Real Age, and when we looked at the 55,000 people who had recent heart attacks who took the Real Age program early on, out of the 18 million we had, the 55,000 had had a heart attack. The women changed their behavior and kept it changed. By and large, meaning it was something like 89% of the women took their meds as directed, they lost weight, they got their blood pressure and cholesterol under control. The men, on the other hand, changed behavior for 2 to 4 months. And by 6 months, if the men were under 57 years of age, and for some reason 57 was an interesting cutoff, if they were under 57, less than 20% of them were following their physician's orders as they self-reported to us 6 months later, as opposed to it was something over 80% of the women. Why is that? Is there anything in that, or is that just a freak of culture?
So I don't know, but let me make a guess, which is that one of the other really powerful motivators of our behavior is when we recruit social pressure for the things that we're trying to accomplish. And it may be that women who tend to be slightly more social and have different kinds of social circles maybe are more readily able to do this in terms of talking about their goal and what they're trying to do and having the social pressure from their friends. I mean social pressure in a good way here, in terms of saying, hey, you know what, I'm trying to lose 15 pounds and I want you to know that, and I want, caring what people think and posting on Facebook about it and so on. If I had to make a guess, I would look there to see if that's what's going on, whether there are more Facebook posts about that kind of thing. Whereas men, and this is only as true as the generality can be, but, tend to be slightly more private about certain of these aspects.
And the second thing we have found in our own program, but it's also when you look at the data we've done with other companies, we've been able to change the health costs and health behaviors at a number of companies. So for the last 4 years, we've had a declining medical cost of care with actually not changing benefits. And that's also true. But there's a group of people in our groups that haven't had the same success. And I'm wondering what we should be doing from a brain standpoint or other relating to that. And that is our minority populations. And it isn't just it doesn't matter where their socioeconomic status is. But our minority populations, and we've looked at the University of Pennsylvania, we've looked at three of the companies also we've worked at, and it turns out whether it is African American or Hispanic, and those are the two that we have enough data on, we aren't changing their behaviors to the same degree as we are the majority Caucasian population. Anything we should be doing differently from a brain motivation standpoint?
Yeah, I feel like there are several things. So first of all, I mentioned this issue about minimizing temptations and putting money online and recruiting social pressure. Those are all really important fronts to have in this war with any group. Also,
I'm losing your. Can you speak up a little? I'm sorry. I know you've got a cold, so can you just talk a little louder, Dr. David?
Yeah, David? Yeah. So,
and okay, we're talking.
Sure.
I should remind people we're talking to a wonderful neuroscientist, David Eagleman, E-A-G-L-E-M-A-N. The book is The Brain, The Story of You. And the reason I'm probing him so deeply on these topics is this is a absolutely sensational book that shows how deep his knowledge is. And so I'm trying to get something that will actually help us in our practice as well. So go ahead, David.
Yeah, so I had mentioned issues about minimizing temptation and putting money on the line and recruiting social pressure. But, you know, another very important issue about steering people's behavior is this issue about involving emotion, because this involves particular networks in your brain that powerfully steer decision-making. And so, you know, the issue about how I'm going to change my behavior around things, there has to be emotion involved here. And I haven't thought deeply about the issue of how you do this differently in different cultures, but I can imagine that a big part of the issue has to do with what counts as emotionally satisfying to reach this kind of goal, or emotionally distressing to not, you know, look a certain way or be in a certain kind of goal. And so I think probably from culture to culture, it's important to identify what is the emotional hook that people care about. That has, of course, a lot to do with what other people are doing. And so that's a big piece of it. And then, you know, and there's one more related issue, which is this issue about establishing habits. So things like portion control in eating is just one kind of example, but I don't know how this differs from culture to culture and how you get different sorts of behaviors that, but this kind of establishing of habits is an important thing for people to do as individuals, but also that would be worth examining culturally how habits sort of differ.
Well, as you can tell, we've done a fair bit of time with our guest, Dr. David Eagleman. The book is The Brain, The Story of You. David, is there a website related to this or a place where people can find out more information?
Yeah, eagleman.com has all my books on it, or pbs.org/thebrain is. I also made a television show on PBS that was nominated for an Emmy. It was a series that was related to the book, and so you can find the television series there.
So you can see and this is a fascinating book with interesting, what I would call fascinating or interesting or unusual insights. It's kind of like Freakonomics for the brain, and teaches you somewhat the same thing. We ought to get Steve Levitt and you together with the. It would be the most interesting story on the brain and our economic behavioral economics.
Right.
David Eagleman is a neuroscientist, New York Times bestselling author. The books are the other books are Incognito, which if you haven't read it, it's The Secret Life of the Brain, and his work of fiction, Some, is an international bestseller, published in 28 languages and turned into two operas. This book is also fascinating, The Brain, The Story of You, and it is available on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble and probably at every other bookstore you can name, but certainly on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I loved reading it. I hope you will, too. And, David, if you come up with any other ideas on what to do, you can email me, ageprooflife@gmail.com, or drmikerealage@gmail.com. That goes to all of our listeners as well with questions. And if they have questions for David again, Hopefully we can get him back on. Obviously, his depth of knowledge, as you've heard, is incredible. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, on Radio MD, iHeart, ShareCare.com, and a number of other outlets. Feel free. This is edition 840. We'll be back next week with, again, the top news, medical news of the week that lets you take control of your genes so you can live at the top of your curve, and with another wonderful guest. In the meantime, remember what David said. Love one another, I guess, would be the be passionate in your events, and especially passionate to your kids and grandkids under the age of 3. Anything else I should add, David?
Nope, that's good. Thanks.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening, and Sonar for wonderful engineering as usual.